From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made on the banks of Seneca Lake in Yates County. A hamlet called Lakemont, just outside the town of Dundee, was for nearly 40 years home to a place called Freedom Village. The campus welcomed what its founder called troubled teens from across the country. Staff used an evangelical curriculum and a structured environment to help the teens work through various challenges. Some had struggled with difficult home environments, others had been abused, some experienced challenges with addiction. If you were to drive by Freedom Village, you would have likely seen a bustling community of people living and working together in an idyllic setting. But many staff and program participants say it was anything but that, and some outsiders describe the setting as like a cult. People who identify as survivors of Freedom Village say that they were subject to mental, emotional, spiritual, and in some cases, sexual abuse. At the center of Freedom Village's mission, controversial practices, and millions of dollars in debt, was Pastor Fletcher Brothers. Brothers seemed to have a talent for drawing people in. He convinced well-meaning, faithful people to join him in his work helping teenagers. But according to survivors, he also heavily punished anyone who questioned him or who acted in ways that he deemed inappropriate. He forced children to carry logs in a circle for hours, sometimes starting at 5 a.m. for 2 hours in the evening, while encouraging others to look down on them. Survivors say he inspired fear in staff and teens to the point where many of them are left with lifelong trauma. You may have read about Freedom Village in local publications like the Finger Lakes Times or through reporting by Gary Craig of the Democrat and Chronicle over the years. But in what could be the first time, a new book offers an insider's perspective of Freedom Village. Mary Rosenberger was born into her life at Freedom Village. Her musically talented parents were among Freedom Village's first staff members, and Mary and her two older siblings were among the campus's well-known staff kids. When she was young, Mary viewed her life at Freedom Village as close to perfect. But at the age of 9, fear started to set in. In her new memoir, Freedom Village, she details her 24 years on the campus and the terror that she endured. She writes about how she viewed Pastor Brothers as a godlike figure who both inspired and terrified her, and how that unraveled after deconstructing years of trauma. This hour, Mary Rosenberger joins us on the program to tell that powerful story. It's one that she says is not just for survivors like herself, but for anyone struggling with spiritual confusion. And I want to welcome Mary to the program. She's the author of Freedom Village, a memoir. Mary Rosenberger, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle. He has covered Freedom Village for a couple of decades now. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Gary, being the generous spirit that he is, reached out to us just a few weeks ago. You had heard about the book, picked it up. But Mary is not someone that you knew through your reporting. This is a new sort of meeting for you.
Very much. We spoke by phone for a story, and this is the first time we've met.
And so I want to just say, first of all, I want to set a little bit of a scene because listeners, we're on WXXI, we're on WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio. We've got a big broad reach throughout the region, and you might be literally driving by listening to us right now on 89.5 FM or listening on the app or wherever, whatever platform you're on. If you know where the FLX Wienery is, it's essentially across the street from where the Wienery is. The FLX Wienery is a great little roadside place to get a hot dog and some other great stuff, and that's down where it is. It's about two-thirds of the way down Seneca Lake on the west side. I have driven by the property many times. I did not know this story until this book. And Gary, I read your work a lot, and I've missed these stories. This is a story I didn't know existed.
Oh, no. I mean, Mary has a perspective that very few do, and she's the only one to tell it because she, I mean, I've talked to people who were there and had some of the experiences that you mentioned earlier, but Mary has a perspective from the inside that really no others don't. My apologies.
And did you find that as well, Gary, as you reported on this starting maybe 2003, around then?
Yes, yes.
That people were kind of confused because it sounds like there was a cult compound in the middle of the Finger Lakes.
Yeah, you touched on, I mean, I think and Mary and I were talking about this earlier before the show, how to sort of the outside world, there was this sort of appearance of all is well. And I started writing about it because I covered federal courts and there was this bankruptcy, that was, you know, $21 million in debt, which is a lot of money. And I, because I was covering federal court, sort of picked up the bankruptcy coverage and then started hearing from people who had been at Freedom Village, who had experiences where similar to what you've talked about. I mean, and some were really, I'm sure Mary will get into this, there was this idea that the world outside was just, this landscape of hell, that, the confines beyond Freedom Village were dangerous. And I mean, I talked to people who were just, they were very unsure of themselves when they went out into the world beyond Freedom Village, because it had become such a sort of cloistered enclave for people. And we've talked about how it was sort of self-perpetuated because people then worked there. So Fletcher Brothers is always able to sort of keep cycling a workforce by people who didn't want to leave.
It certainly isn't to this level. But M. Night Shyamalan created a movie called The Village. And the premise of the movie was a group of people in modern society who didn't trust the world and thought they were the authority and they had to protect people. And they created this village in the woods and basically raised children to believe that they're in the 1700s and they're out away from technology, cloistered away from the world. So Mary, your first memories of childhood are what?
Definitely growing up around that campus. We lived in a home that had been purchased by the ministry. A lot of the staff families lived in homes that were owned by Freedom Village. And so we lived about a mile away, but my whole life was on that campus. Most of my only friends were other staff kids. Just spent so much time either with my mom, who was a music director, just hanging out in all of her rehearsals. My dad was a fundraiser, so I'd be in his office. It really was a very well-contained atmosphere where everybody knew everybody. All of my friends' parents knew me. Everyone in a healthy circumstance, it would be a beautiful thing. But it just was not at the end of the day.
How many people were on the campus typically?
Well, I think at its height, the program had over 200 kids in it, usually heavier on the boys. So I think there was maybe 120 or so boys and the rest girls. By the time I was adolescent, I would say there were maybe 15 or 20 staff families, security officers, groundskeepers, office buildings. There were two schools for the program kids, just offices full. It was bustling. Like it was always full of life. There was a whole horse pasture, a whole horse program with an arena. They were giving trails rides. It was, as our pastor would say, anybody that accused us of being a cult it's got to be the first cult that runs bus tours to see it, because people would be coming. There were visitors often. So it made it that much more difficult to see it as a cult, because we were so sequestered. But unlike that movie, The Village, we were also kind of trained to be missionaries. So it was a weird mindset because we were very secluded and contained. But when we did go out, it was with the vantage point of a missionary. So to me, at least as a kid growing up there, it was like a failsafe in my brain to see the outside world for what it was. I just saw it as a place that needed to be saved. So I wasn't always there. Like I toured eventually for years in a singing group. My mom owned a ballet school in town. But even as I was out in the world, it didn't seem like my world. It seemed like a mission field.
Mary Rosenberger's book is called Freedom Village, A Memoir. It's available now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very brisk read. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful and very direct. And I will say, Mary is a very generous person in the way that you write. You write in a spirit that is open to healing, that is open to forgiving even the people who have perpetrated a lot of pain. And I admire that about you. And we're going to talk about that. Where do you want people to find Freedom Village, A Memoir?
So you can order it from thriftbooks.com. You can order it from my blog website. That is www.wearetheoutsiders.com. It's available through my publisher's website, which is payettpublishing.com, P-A-Y-E-T-T-E. And it is available through Amazon. They're giving us a little bit of a hard time with shipping times. So I'm a proponent of how you're going to get the book the fastest. If you want a hardcover, go to Thrift Books.
I think Bezos will be fine if you buy it elsewhere. But anyway, those are the multiple platforms, and listeners, we'll have that in our show notes for you if you want to pick up the book yourself. And before we really kind of get into Mary's story, Gary Craig, the story of who this person was, Pastor Fletcher Brothers, whom Mary, again, generously doesn't even name, just refers to just Pastor in the book. But this is someone who had a history that extended all the way up here in Rochester, even before going down to the Finger Lakes. Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. He started with Gates Church, a small Gates church in Gates here. And it was at the time in the early 80s when there was sort of this rise of the evangelical ministry at the start of the Reagan administration, et cetera. And he was basically building a church and a congregation on anti-pornography, anti-rock music, anti-homosexuality, a lot of antis, not a lot of pros. And there was an audience to hear that. But even if you go back to then, sort of the template of what would happen later was there. I mean, he ended up bankrupt. He ended up, I think, about $1 million bankrupt, but he had raised enough money somehow to start Freedom Village, as you said, there in the West Bank of Seneca Lake. And that, so he got himself out of the first bankruptcy. And then he also, a lot of the money that was supposed to go to something else gave him a radio ministry that he started, which became very, very popular. He has a very sort of folksy way about him. And you could see how people would be drawn to, A, his presentation, and B, the mission as it was laid out, which is, we've got these troubled teens. We're going to really help them. And Freedom Village gets up and going, and, next thing you know, he's living a fairly lavish lifestyle as opposed to others on the campus. And he's raising tons of money with supposed loans, not even yet. It's like, here, we're going to give you, 14% back on your dollar, and we're going to be helping these kids. This time, the next bankruptcy is $21 million in the 1990s. And that bankruptcy doesn't get resolved for 20-plus years.
And Freedom Village opened in 1981.
Correct.
Yes. So he had been up here in Gates. Mm-hmm. That falls apart. He goes down, starts Freedom Village on Seneca Lake in 1981.
Yes.
And the next bankruptcy is a much bigger bankruptcy.
Yeah, and it took 20 years to resolve. So that's sort of when my coverage started covering the bankruptcy. And it was, people got, I think ultimately got 20 cents on the dollar. And it was sad because I was talking to people, well-meaning, well-intentioned people who had, heard the radio show. Yeah, and I remember talking to one woman whose dad gave, and I don't think this is a guy who had $150,000 to give, but he did. He gave $150,000, and that was not uncommon. There were thousands of donors who had done something like that.
And so Gary starts reporting because of the bankruptcy stuff.
Yes.
But underneath the surface was different kinds of abuse here, which we will talk about. But this is also, over the years, an organization that the courts knew of, and the courts would sometimes send kids there, right? Through the court system, as I understand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right, Mary?
Yep. My husband came to the program through the court system, actually. The teenager who would end up being my husband. But yes, a lot of kids they came from detention centers. They came from legal systems where it was jail, or Freedom Village was presented as a rehabilitation option, one-year program.
Can you describe the pastor? Gary kind of talked about him. He had that radio program. He did have a lure to him. Mm-hmm. How would you describe him?
The most believable man. I mean, he is very, very inspiring and terrifying and just someone that it seems, and of course for me, I was born at Freedom Village. I didn't know a life without this man being the supreme authority of my life. But so in a sense, I didn't really have a chance. But the fact that other people that were grown adults that came there to work, or parents, or these donors, the fact that people who had minds of their own were still so influenced by his personality. He's very large in spirit and in stature. He's a domineering guy. In my whole life, I've watched people react to him when he walks into a room. It's either respect or curiosity, or he's just not somebody that slips under the radar. He's very attractive.
And what your book describes is someone who is attractive in those settings, but when you live in Freedom Village, what you start to understand is he becomes a figure of fear for a lot of people. His demand to have control extended everywhere. in some bizarre ways that we're going to talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
But paint a picture for listeners on the kind of control that he had on what girls could wear, what young women were allowed to wear, his expectations for how much control he could have in your personal life. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Mm-hmm. It really was. Well, if you came there in the program, makes a little more sense that you would be signing up to live under those standards, like a boarding school. That's not totally unnatural that you're going to submit yourself to the structure that you're in.
Sure, a dress code may
right.
be.
But for staff, that's where it gets strange, is no organization would have that much control over what the staff people are doing. But that's where it felt more like a church in that way, where everyone is doing this. We all have the same beliefs. And even if we didn't, we were expected to uphold Fletcher's beliefs. But I had all of the same beliefs as him. So to me, it just seemed like what we did. We were very conservative Christian fundamental Baptists. So that's dresses, very conservative modesty standards. We weren't allowed to wear pants or anything like that until a certain point, when Fletcher's first wife left and his new wife wanted to wear pants. So all of a sudden our convictions changed and we were allowed to wear pants. But everything was under a microscope, how tight your shirt is. What's your hair? We couldn't have our hair wet. We couldn't walk around with wet hair.
Because why?
Because apparently it made men lust, because it made them think of us in the shower.
I just believed it all. You thought that was normal? You thought
totally normal. Yeah. Well, I just thought, I just don't want to be the cause for any man to stumble. There's Bible verses galore that were, I think the reason why he held so much control is that it was religious. So when you bring in the Bible and you use verses and scripture to support your standards, nobody questions it, because at least to me, that was the same as questioning God and his word. So why would I wonder why I have to do this? God says to do it, I'll do it.
You were 9 years old when you write that even just a few years ago, if you would have asked me when I got saved, I would have told you that it happened on this night when I was 9 years old. What happened?
Mm-hmm. So in religious circles, Christian ones, there's terms like saved and unsaved. Basically is meaning, when did you decide to be a Christian? When did you invite Jesus into your heart? All of these terms that are very religious, but it's the only way I thought. So I knew that at some point I would get saved. I would make a decision for myself to be a Christian. And we were taught about something called the age of accountability, which is actually nowhere in the Bible, but for some reason it just seemed so true that you have to make that decision by a certain point. So it's like if you make that decision by the time you're 9 or 10, then if you die, you won't go to hell, basically. So I find it interesting that I was taught that that age starts right around 9 years old. They would say that's when you start to want bad things. It's when you start to desire to disobey your parents.
Pretty heavy for a 9-year-old.
Pretty heavy, but go figure, I made the decision at 9. So I'm looking back going, oh, Mary, like you just wanted to get that done as soon as possible. And the rewards and the affirmation that happened to specifically teenagers that I grew up watching them make this decision. If you've ever been in a church that has altar calls, they call people to come forward on their knees. They're praying for salvation. I've watched that happen so many times. So I just knew that's coming for me. I think in the back of my mind, in hindsight, I knew that I would be affirmed. I knew that I wouldn't be an outsider within my own community, because there were kids that didn't make that decision and they were not treated well. You know, you're always looked at as like, oh, well, she's not ready yet, so we're not going to give them any type of like leadership or maybe they were dropped down in levels.
So I want you to describe for listeners the level system here, because so far listeners might be saying, well, you know, this sounds like a domineering pastor, but like, you know, where does the worship or the cult, like, so he had established his own system of levels that he would put kids and staff and people on, anybody in that community. And at the bottom was no level, which you did not want to be on. And what would happen if you would drop you down levels, there would be different penalties. But one of the penalties that's just hard to get your head around is he would have kids just carrying wood,
mm-hmm.
walking in circles for hours as a penalty.
Yep. Yep. Corporal punishment. Think about what you've done. There's no out for you. You can't. It was a culture where you could not say no. You couldn't refuse to do things, or you would dig yourself into a deeper, deeper, deeper hell, ultimately ending up on isolation, which was you're stuck in a room alone and you're being monitored outside. You can't leave. You can't talk to anybody else. The staff, these were program rules. Again, it started out with only program kids had to deal with these punishments and these levels. But by the time I was a teenager, it was in the staff as well. So nobody was really safe from, especially if you had come through the program and stayed on as staff, at any moment you could have everything taken away from you. And staff kids as well. Our parents had no say over that.
And you wrote that he seemed to show favoritism to certain people,
mm-hmm.
but with most people, you included, he could just be in a bad mood and you don't know even what sets him off. There's mm-hmm. a scene where you're walking with your sister
mm-hmm.
and you encounter the pastor and he thinks that you're wearing makeup
mm-hmm.
and your sister sort of freaks out and realizes like, and then kind of tries to show the pastor.
Mm-hmm.
She's not wearing makeup. Like, mm-hmm. And what did she do?
She rubbed her hand across my eyes real hard just to
prove that there was no makeup.
To prove that there was no makeup on, which funny is like probably the most rogue, disrespectful thing I ever dared to do was to put on mascara the night before I went to sleep and then wake up and go to school so that I could technically say I didn't put any makeup on that
day. Someone says, did you put makeup on today?
Right. I would have said, I don't have any makeup on today. No, I woke up and just came. But so I probably had something. And that was the level of minutiae that we all lived under is at any minute, is he going to think my eye has something on it? And what's going to happen? You know, he could do whatever he wanted all the time.
What if you wanted to write letters to people on the outside, though?
Well, that's the thing, is where it does get down to my story alone. I think I was definitely more heavily brainwashed than everybody else there because I never wanted to. It was so saturated in my mind to take care of that in advance that I never wanted to talk to my friends who had left. I never wanted to write letters. I just thought, they're gone. They're against us. The work was already done. I didn't see that as a thing.
You read in your book, quote, "I silently suffered in shame each day from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep. Of course, I didn't acknowledge those deep-seated feelings as unhealthy. I dismissed the weight of shame and anxiety as the cost of serving Jesus. It didn't matter how I felt. It only mattered that I pleased him with my life," end quote. And you're talking about serving him, capital H, him, God, but clearly the young you was also worried about serving the pastor.
Right.
And you acknowledge that.
Right.
Were there times when you would, you know, think to yourself, maybe late at night one night, you know, this guy is not what he is cracked up to be? Like, I don't...
No. No. Never. Never, never, never. I would turn against my parents before I would turn against him.
It's amazing to hear.
Yeah. Never. And never crossed my mind.
What did your parents think about the pastor?
Well, that's been an interesting journey to learn about. And now I'm getting to the age, I'm 37, so I'm getting to the age where you start to realize that your parents were doing the best they could because none of us know what we're doing, really. But I believe they had pure hearts of service. I think they saw an opportunity that he gave to them to live a life of service to other people. But my mom was specifically preyed upon by this pastor, and my dad was extremely devoted to him as a friend.
I'm curious, Mary. We'll get to, because I'm sure listeners want to understand when you're 24 years old and everything changes, and but you know, you say that you viewed the pastor as this godlike figure, but as you are starting to get older, it's the pastor who is standing in the way of you developing relationships that you wanted. So there's a guy,
mm-hmm.
pretty good dude,
mm-hmm.
who you were very close with. And you knew as a teenager, you're 15, 16, that you're falling in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
But there were intense rules about if boys and girls could even talk to each other. And this is like the scene that I can't even really even picture is like real, is the idea that a boy would have to kneel down in front of the pastor and ask for talking privileges.
Right.
Or dating privileges. Like literally get on one knee in front of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that?
Yeah. Again, something it was just a normal part of my life, watching people who wanted to be in relationships. It was always the boy that would go up and take the knee and ask for talking permission. And that was the first step of a relationship.
And if the pastor said no, they couldn't talk to the girl.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it was always sort of like a weird, like, how a boy will ask for his fiance's hand in marriage from the father. Yeah. So then it's not really a surprise. So it wasn't a surprise. It was a pre-planned thing. But usually the girl didn't know. So it was just over and over these weird displays of submission to the pastor. But they carried excitement and good things with them. So again, no one took the time to think, why are we asking him? It was just like, oh, a relationship. It was just strange.
Okay. And so with Mike, you know he's interested. You know you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody around you apparently knows you're interested. And the pastor, your description, it's like he's using this in ways. Even mm-hmm. when he grants you the privilege of being able to spend time together, in a way it was to actually limit your time mm-hmm. or to kind of mess with you. And even then I'm going like, this is where Mary's going to wake up and be like, this guy is awful. This guy's a monster.
She doesn't wake up. Spoiler. She doesn't wake up.
Yeah. But, you know, you persevered through a lot
yeah.
to end up with him.
Yes.
There's a really beautiful moment where the first time he tells you he loves you. And I know, you know, you've never forgotten that moment. And yet, do you ever look back and say, that shouldn't have been on a chaperone date with parents sitting at the next table? We shouldn't have, that shouldn't have been stolen, all these moments that should have been yours.
Mm.
Were kind of stolen from
mm-hmm.
you. Do you feel that way now?
I feel that way now. Then, again, I did not have anything to measure anything against. This is the only normal I knew. It was the only normal of everybody else I knew. So I was just grateful that my parents sat at a different table. In that restaurant.
Generous of them under
so
the circumstances.
Generous. Yeah. Yes.
Now, to be clear at this point, I should say, Mary, I'll let you answer the question, and I'll let Gary talk about some of the other reporting outside this is. Freedom Village is what we're talking about. If you're just joining us, Mary Rosenberger is the author of Freedom Village, a memoir, and it is a new book detailing an insider's perspective on this village that existed for decades on the shores of Seneca Lake, on the west side of Seneca Lake. About two-thirds of the way down the lake in Lakemont. Opened in 1981. A very, very religious community that ended up with a lot of pain and abuse and trauma. Were you ever physically or sexually abused?
No.
Okay. Others who went there, Gary, the allegation is others, kids who ended up in the program, had different experiences from Mary. Mary's describing emotional, sometimes what I would think verbal abuse or even spiritual abuse. The physical abuse, those allegations do exist in different cases, right?
Yes. And you know, there are, you know, any or too many. I don't want to make it sound like there were dozens upon dozens, but there were a handful of lawsuits. I can't remember if it was five or six or so, but individuals. And the stories would kind of vary. There would be people who were on staff who had, in one case, you know, basically a sex offense in the past. And was put in the room with a kid and sexual abuse. I mean, that one clearly happened. There was a conviction and everything. And there were other allegations that went to lawsuits, very similar allegations. And Mary will probably remember better than I some of this. And I believe all of those are now settled. But basically, you had this sort of handful of cases in which it's not as if I don't want to imply that like you know, the pastor himself was doing this, but clearly a lack of oversight with you could say maybe even who was being hired, but even if you hire them hoping for the best, who you're allowing these kids access to if they have histories of sexual abuse.
Yeah. So, Mary, over time, with your blogging, your online writing, and now this book, I know others have reached out to you. You've probably heard a lot of stories, haven't you?
Yes.
And
yeah.
There's a lot of pain out there.
A lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you believe most of those stories are true?
I do.
Yeah.
And there are some written that I know aren't. There's some sensational stories that because I was there so long, I know that, that some of that's not true, but most of the abusive allegations are completely, completely true.
And so over the years when the media, the Big M media, which sometimes mm-hmm. included one of our guests, Gary mm-hmm. Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle, when they would write about Freedom Village, it was often covering things like the bankruptcies or over time, you know, different stories start to come out. And the pastor was aware of that. And he had a very strong view of the media in general, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
What did he say about journalists?
Out to get us. Very paranoid.
Don't trust them.
Don't trust them. You throw in the Satanist seasoning. All of our food was seasoned with fear of the Satanists. And conveniently, anyone that was against us was a Satanist. So the Democrat and Chronicle newspaper, totally against
I'm going right from here to the ritual, actually.
Yeah,
is that
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Yep.
As a Satanist?
Yes.
I knew it.
Exactly.
No, I mean, it's an effective tool, though, because if you're growing up there and that's all you learn and that's the authority figure,
mm-hmm.
you probably think, okay.
Totally.
You believe it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're going to get to what happened next in this remarkable story. I want to grab a phone call from Rich in Rochester. Hey, Rich, go ahead.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Very good, sir.
As you know, I've spoken to Evan many times. I'm an atheist, and I think religion and any type of thing where you keep people separate can lead to these things. And this is a horrible story. I'm not surprised to hear the story, though. Anytime that I hear a religious group has done something, I'm very much not surprised of the actions that were happened. And I just wonder if your guest can touch on that, is in the problem with religion itself causing these issues.
Rich,
I don't know.
So Rich, it's a fair question. And I'll say that if you follow Mary online now, or if you read the book, you'll know that, yeah, there was a moment where you went all the way down to zero and said, do I believe any of this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And you had to kind of strip it all away mm-hmm. and then ask yourself what you did believe.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with Rich's concern. He's worried that some of these environments lead themselves to this kind of abuse. What do you think?
I think he's right. I think the problem with religion is that it attaches itself to people who take authority and then tell you what God is like. And people that don't want to do the spiritual work for themselves, or they don't believe that they're able to, they believe that they need a human being to connect them to God, are the most vulnerable people and always get taken advantage of. And what I now know God to be, after stripping everything down, the reason I still land in the realm of Christianity is because I think the true good part of a Christian or someone that is like Christ is there is no separation from other people. That should be the biggest red flag of communities like this, is that it divides you from other people in the name of God. So I know now, if I'm ever to be told a message that the fruit of it or the result of it is going to be me dividing myself from somebody, that is not a Christ-like path to follow. It's just unfortunate that so many people follow that.
But you didn't reject the notion of God,
mm-hmm.
of Christianity, and your relationship with that, ultimately. You developed a different relationship mm-hmm. and a new one,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't leave it behind entirely.
No. And I did spend some time there. I think it was really important for me to investigate other points of view, obviously, other religions, non-religion. I just wanted to know what was true. And if I believed in my heart, or I'm a discerning person. I seem to have a good, which is ironic because I wasn't able to use that tool.
I think now with some reflection, you've probably become very discerning.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I think the more you know a lie, the more you can tell what the truth is. That's why it was enlightening for me to see that these were lies that I was taught, which then my curiosity just went, well, then what is true? I'll look everywhere. And I think there's a saying, I believe it's C.S. Lewis that wrote that everyone has to deconstruct something to come to God. He himself deconstructed his atheism. some people have to deconstruct their religion, there's always going to be a flipping upside down of what you thought you knew. For me, it was God being a controlling, terrifying monster who would bless me if I was good enough.
But generally, you agree with Rich's concern that religion or the structure of religion can be used to elevate powerful and dangerous people.
It is always used to do that. Yes.
And when you were growing up, you would have heard Rich say, well, I'm an atheist, and you would have thought, you were taught to think what about someone like that?
Save him. I can save you. Yeah.
What do you think today?
I would want to sit and have coffee with Rich. I would want to have a conversation to learn about his point of view, which is something that I could never have conceived of doing. Everything was agenda-based, which is not connected, genuinely.
Mary Rosenberg is our guest, the author of the new book, Freedom Village, A Memoir. She is a survivor of Freedom Village that existed before it closed for decades on the west side of Seneca Lake, on the shores of Seneca Lake, in a hamlet called Lakemont. Today, if you're looking for a landmark and you're driving south toward Watkins Glen, you'll pass the FLX Wienery on your right, and just off to the left is where Freedom Village was. What's, by the way, before we go to break here, Mary, what's there today now?
Still sitting there empty.
It's just an empty campus?
It's been bought, parceled, but it is literally a ghost town. It's completely eerie to be there.
Gary Craig, have you explored that?
You know, they had to sell it in 2019, I believe it was, to pay off. His last attempt at bankruptcy, the third or fourth, failed. Bankruptcy judge said, no, you got to pay your debts. And the only way, if you go back and read sort of what they were saying online, Fletcher and others, it was they were leaving New York because of the hedonism that is rampant in New York. They left New York because they had to sell the property to pay off their debts. And well, that's a whole other story maybe we'll get to about how ultimately they failed going anywhere. But they did sell off the property, but best I've heard, very little has happened there so far.
And then as far as we know, the pastor, ostensible pastor, I'm not sure if he's ever been certified.
No, he's not ordained.
Yes.
Fletcher Brothers is now living in the South somewhere. He's moved around a bit. He tried to go to South Carolina, tried to basically recreate this whole deal in South Carolina, and a bunch of people from Freedom Village went down there and were like, do not.
Yes.
Do not. And they blocked it effectively. And so he was not able to go there. Moves to Florida now. I guess he's in somewhere in the South. Mississippi.
Yes.
Mississippi. Mm-hmm.
So, which is news to me. I still thought, thankfully, Mary brought me up to speed.
78 years old down there and quite a legacy. Let's take this only break. We'll come right back with Mary Rosenberg. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. Todd Moss joins me in the first hour. He is a Rochester native who worked in the U.S. State Department. He worked in African Affairs. And now he joins us to look ahead to the Trump administration, the cabinet appointees, and the future of U.S. diplomacy. In our second hour, a conversation about medical aid in dying. Talk with you Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Marsha writes to us to say, every religious cult has restrictions on women's appearance, so they will not entice men sexually. Why were men or boys never taught just how to act respectfully towards women? Fair question from Marsha. What do you think?
It's a great question. I wish someone would have asked it at Freedom Village.
But maybe related to that, Marsha, is some of what started to turn things at Freedom Village, which is when you are governing as he went by pastor, he wasn't ordained, but Fletcher Brothers was in charge, a godlike figure on this campus on Seneca Lake. And yet when you have all these very strict rules for others, and then people see that you are not following those rules, or you seem to have totally different standards for your own life, that hypocrisy starts to rub people the wrong way. Do you want to describe some of what started to turn there?
Mm-hmm. So my family was one of the first, I guess, quote unquote, founding families of Freedom Village. My parents were very, very inner circle, very, very close to this family of Fletcher Brothers and his kids and wife. So when I was around 9 or 10, his wife was gone, at least to my mind. I was not privy to all of the, you know, staff things back then. But she left and they got divorced. And again, the questions were so kept at bay. From my vantage point, I would have said nobody ever questioned him. But now looking back, I can see that the staff people who abruptly left had questioned him. And so that's what began to happen when he effectively split up another staff couple that woman's husband left the ministry, and then he went to date her and eventually married her. And so in those days when they were dating, like you said, we had a lot of heavy rules about dating, and couldn't be alone. You couldn't be within 6 inches of each other. This was even for staff people, that my father saw this woman's car at our pastor's house and found them in there alone. And maybe the one of the only times that he actually confronted him and said, you can't do something that you're preaching using scripture as your basis. You can't do something that you're telling us all we can, we're not allowed to do. And my dad was fired for that, which I believe was a power grab to just let my dad know who actually was the authority of our family. My parents both said, you can't make us leave somewhere God has called us to be. They were pretty firm and like, no, we're meant to be here and we're not leaving. And despite the fact that he could have told them to leave, I think it was enough that they knew never to do that again.
Which, by the way, Mary, we have limited time, so we're telling a story that is the core of this story. But sprinkled into this story is Mary's respect for many of the people who did try to do good work at this place and impacted many kids in good, positive ways. And you view your parents as doing their best. So what happens next now?
So next, the bullseye is on my family. I think from that point on, my parents' marriage was very much under the microscope, very attacked constantly by this pastor who was a womanizer, I guess is the best way to put it. No woman felt comfortable around him for good reason, because he would make women feel uncomfortable. And so after that, I think from my vantage point now, it seems like he wanted to ruin our family. I don't think he liked that my dad went nose to nose with him in that moment. And from that point on, it was attack after attack to divide my siblings and I from each other, to reduce our respect for our parents, to listen to our pastor above our parents. And he would use scripture to support that. He would preach that from the pulpit, that he was our parent in the Lord, which meant you obey your parents in the Lord. That doesn't mean your actual parents. That means your spiritual authority. Convenient.
And you and Mike, you know, despite everything you went through, you end up building this very strong relationship, this wonderful marriage. And when do you realize that you and him really, you can leave? Like this, we can do this.
Mm-hmm. So in 2011, the ministry started to crumble a little bit. That same wife that had been swept up in the 90s left. It was the same pattern exactly again, that our pastor's wife was gone. Nobody knew what was happening. At this point, I was 24, so I was in the middle of people saying, where did she go? And wouldn't you know it, she was a Satanist. So, yeah. And a lesbian, like just whatever.
He says she was a lesbian.
Yes, a lesbian Satanist.
Okay.
Many, many inappropriate, awkward staff meetings where he was just dumping all of this strange information on all of us to get us to not want to reach out to her. And shortly thereafter, he had a girlfriend that was 40 years younger than him with a small child. It was bizarre. In the middle of all of that, I was pregnant with my second child. So I was sort of out of the mix, which I see as a mercy now, because I was somewhat separated from it. And I just watched as the elders, my father being one of them, the board, his board, which had no legality to it at all at the end of the day, but the people in charge, it was absurd enough that they said, wait, you can't do this. You cannot expect us all to just ignore the fact that your wife is gone and you have a girlfriend who's very young. This is absurd. You need to step down or you're going to lose everybody. And he just said, let them leave. And so probably 85 or 90% of the staff left in 2011. My family went. We watched a lot of people that we respected resign. I think that helped my mind, because for me, I couldn't conceive of wanting to leave without our pastor's blessing. I couldn't conceive of it. But over a long period of time of people leaving, resigning, my husband and I ultimately resigned the day after giving birth to my son in the hospital. So my parents resigned a couple days before that, and we came home with a new baby and a two-year-old to a house. We had to leave a whole new life ahead of us.
And now you write this memoir, and you've reflected a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you write the book to begin with?
I wrote the book as an adaptation of my blog. I started this blog in 2018. In 2017, my kids had all turned the age. They were all in school. Before that was very blurry motherhood, three kids in 3.5 years, insanity. But when they were all in school, I got my first real job at a cafe. And that's when I started to talk about my life because first thing people ask you is, where are you from? And I would say, do you have a minute? Because I know what's going to happen. Start talking about Freedom Village. And through 6 years of working there, I started to realize people want to know about this story. I started a blog just to write chapters about it because I didn't have time. We don't have time. There's no time to get into the story. And it was through that process of writing this blog in 2018 that I discovered myself. It started out to let people know, but over the course of a year, I was learning about my life with my readers. It was incredibly cathartic. It was completely healing. Epiphanies were abounding. And I had sort of this audience of readers that was with me in it. So that was finished at the end of 2018. As I continued to work in that cafe, meeting people, they were reading the blog, the audience was building. I knew last summer, or the summer of 2023, it was time to write the book as a natural overflow. I can't keep having these conversations
well,
in real life.
And I know it's helping other people who've already reached out to you. Mm-hmm. I will say, when you tell people you're from Freedom Village, for those who don't know the story, I think of the late writer, one of my favorite writers, David Rakoff, used to say that, boy, the glitzier the name... The moral, he says, it's always like it's the Basket of Puppies Foundation. Then it's like, blah, like the real truth of it. So the Freedom Village was the least free place you could probably have ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to read a little bit of what you wrote about what you're dealing with through this process. I want to ask you about how you're doing today. You wrote, quote, "I have fought long, hard battles against the fear that I will do something wrong, maybe even without realizing it. And I will cost my whole family God's blessings. That fear has led me to feel scrutinized by people 100% of the time I'm around them. If someone is upset with me, I have had a very hard time dealing with it. I've struggled with believing people are upset with me when, in fact, they aren't and have no reason to be. My childhood molded who I am today, and the process of untangling lies from the truth is ongoing." End quote. But you do write in the book that you don't fear that pastor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're not scared of him at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You've left that behind at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's huge, isn't it?
I think that was actually the first domino, was getting to the end of that blog writing, realizing that my pastor was just a man, the same as me, not beneath me, not above me, just completely equal. That's when I started to think maybe I was wrong about God. And for me, that has always been the most important thing in my life, is my relationship with God. So realizing that I had been sort of locked in a room with a monster in my relationship with God felt like good news at the time, because I knew something else must be true. And the fear that has drained out of my life has been contingent upon discovering who I believe God to be now, which is kindness and love and compassion and mercy, the God I should have been taught about all along.
That's beautiful. And you're doing well these days?
Doing well, yes. I have a sound mind. That's how I describe it. And that's actually a miracle, being around people who were sharing their testimonies, were talking about their past and how God had saved them and changed them. I now see the red flag of troubled teen industry programs being a quick fix.
Yeah.
Someone having a transformational spiritual journey doesn't take 3 months. It takes years. And I believe that's what I've actually been on, is a change of mind. And the result is a mind that is clear and sound after a lifetime of complete mental turmoil constantly. It's
Gary,
a miracle.
Gary Craig, is this a closed book now, or are there still questions that you think need to be answered?
Oh, I think there are questions. I mean, separate from Mary's story, which is so powerful, as you've heard here, And since Freedom Village is gone and it's shut down, and though maybe he's still making lots of money in Mississippi, I don't know. To me, one of the – and if you go back to Mike Ziegler, was the first reporter to write about it. He was raising this question in the 90s in columns, as who's watching over this? And whether it was federal authorities with the issue of the use of the money, whether it's the Attorney General's office, which kind of paid a little bit of attention when it was starting to shut down, whether it's the Office of Children and Family Services, which did regular inspections but somehow never heard any of the stories that came out plentifully later on. That's, to me, one of the things that still I don't think we'll ever get any answers if somebody should have stepped in earlier, but that's a question I've always had.
I went back and read some of what Ziegler wrote and some of what you wrote. Yeah. And I will just say it's just another – as you look back at this very sad, frankly tragic story, there were journalists at least trying to raise questions, and I hope that people understand the value of local journalism. It's important work.
Thanks, Evan.
Really, really important work. And Mary, as we close here, tell people where you want them to find Freedom Village, a memoir.
Sure. So I actually have a book signing this Saturday in Dundee at the library at noon till 1:30. I'll be there with hard copies. If you can't find me out in the wild, you can order online from thriftbooks.com, barnesandnoble.com, my website, wearetheoutsiders.com, or payettpublishing.com.
Really admire you. You've done a really, really great service to our region in telling a story that a lot of people did not know was happening under a lot of people's noses. I'm sorry what you went through, but it's a powerful book, and I thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Mary Rosenberger, the book is Freedom Village, a Memoir. And Gary Craig, Democrat and Chronicle reporter, has covered this story over the years. Thank you for being back with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Evan.
Nice
appreciate
to see
it.
You here. From all of us at Connections, this is day one of our end-of-the-year membership campaign. And I hope you are a member of your public media. But if you are not, you want to get on wxxi.org/give, join this wonderful community, support local journalism. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.